Vinyl sale for WILL's Illinois Radio Reader is Saturday, May 17th at Lincoln Square Village, Urbana. Donate your CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment at any Busey Bank location in Champaign and Urbana. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
Today's broadcast is made possible by The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta, 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, we're going to talk about our kitchens with writer Stephen Gudula. He is the author of The Warmest Room in the House, How the Kitchen Became the Heart of the 20th Century American Home. He quotes Thomas Jefferson early in the book. Jefferson observed that if you want to know a culture, look into the people's pots and eat their bread. Gudula says, quote, "The ingredients in use and the manner in which they are cooked give insight into the economic, geographic, ethnic, religious, and even political influences that come in and out of that society's kitchen doors." Stephen Gudula's work has appeared in several magazines, including Details, The Washington Post, The Advocate, and Cooking Light. His book, The Warmest Room in the House, How the Kitchen Became the Heart of the 20th Century American Home, is published by Bloomsbury. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, Celeste, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. What a fun book this is.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun to write. It really was.
When did you begin and how did you begin to look at the kitchen as cultural time capsule?
Well, there were a couple of things involved with that. It grew out of an article, and I have to give credit where it's due. It grew out of an article that I had written for Cooking Light, where they asked me to just examine 50 years of kitchen design. And as I started to do that, I realized, looking back at the kitchen that I'd grown up in, I looked at the way some of these design elements came into play in my parents' kitchen. For instance, the crock pot on the counter during the 70s, because both of my parents worked. My father was a school teacher, and he actually took odd jobs in the evening and during the summer, and my mother was a bookkeeper. So with both of them out of the house during the day, a lot of times my dad would come home, start the meal first, but there were other times when he knew that he would be getting home later, and so we relied on the crock pot. But that was one of the things that I had encountered when looking at the trends in the kitchen for this particular article. And I thought, you know, I want to look at this from a larger standpoint. I want to take a step back. So I started discussing it with actually the person who became my editor, and we took on the 20th century as the focus for the book. And we went decade by decade and just wanted to see the different influences that came into the room. But ultimately what we were trying to answer was, why is this the place in the house where, at least in my experience and the experience of a lot of people that I've spoken with, why is this the room that we all crowd into? We have these wonderful living rooms, we have dining rooms, but yet, even before the meal is prepared, everybody crowds into the kitchen because we want to be next to the cook, to the stove, the center of the action. It's interesting. So I wanted to see, how did we go about creating this welcoming environment?
Yeah, and it wasn't always that way, that the kitchen was the place where you would socialize. That would be the last place you would socialize.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I like to say that it was not the warmest room in the house. It was the hottest room
yeah.
in the house, especially with the standing cook stove. I know that a lot of the older kitchens in the older homes had proper ventilation, but still there was a lot of smoke. There was a great deal of soot. There was a lot of grease, a lot of heat. And it was not some place where you would want to sit and have a cup of coffee while you had a roast in the oven. First of all, you wouldn't have the time for that sort of leisurely approach to cooking. But back in the early 1900s, we started to move toward that. And that was one of the things that I wanted to look at. And, of course, with the domestic science movement in the early 1900s, we have, first of all, the kitchen starting to become more like a laboratory because the emphasis was on a scientific approach, as it were, on precision, on eliminating anything that could have something to do with guesswork or eliminating anything that that posed a threat to the cook. For instance, cleaner surfaces. And also, I'm thinking, for instance, I was jumping ahead of myself. I was thinking of The Jungle, Upton Sinclair, and creating a germ-free environment. So that was where I started, and we just went from there.
Yeah. Tell us about the Hoosier.
The Hoosier. Love the Hoosier. As Terrence Uber from Kent State had said to me, you know, that was sort of your all-in-one. And during this period first few decades of the century, the Hoosier was the place where you stored your cooking utensils. It was a place to store ingredients, but it also presented a nice, clean countertop surface, which was new and was sort of a place where, and I like this because I like to bring in Frank Lloyd Wright, actually, in this part, because he was designing kitchens at that time where there were what he called crack-free areas. Mm-hmm. And so the Hoosier sort of presented that as well, an opportunity where you could work, and it lessened the steps. So physically physically it lessened the amount of walking that the cook had to do in the kitchen, and you had everything combined in one area. And those actually came back into popularity. I know that in the late 80s we started to see them. There was a trend of them popping up in the 90s, and even in the new millennium, we've seen them come back.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright, because some years ago I went to Springfield and toured the Dana Thomas House.
Okay.
And I thought to myself, it was a remarkably modern kitchen, and forgive me, I don't remember when that house was built. The complaint I had about it was dark, but outside of that, there were these wonderful cupboards and lots of counter space.
Sure, sure. As early as, I think, 1906, he started to propose what we would call the fitted kitchen, a more fitted kitchen with cabinets overhead and the long-running countertops and storage underneath. And his emphasis was, again, on this sort of crack-free. So there was no place where germs or dirt or grease could run, hide, and create problems later. But it's interesting because that in itself also owes a debt to Catherine Beecher from the 19th century, and her drawings for what she considered to be an ideal kitchen were very similar to the things that Wright ended up designing.
Yeah, well, now, not all that far from the studio where I'm sitting is a building on campus named after Isabel Bevere.
Right, right.
Bevere Hall. Tell us about her and what was her contribution in this movement.
Sure, sure. Well, one of the great things about Bevere was, and I don't want to overuse the Martha Stewart reference, but she really had an all-encompassing approach to her curriculum, to the household science curriculum. And I think that she may have had maybe she felt a little bit ahead of the other domestic scientists at the time, and rightfully so, because Laura Shapiro in Perfection Salad had said that one of the things that Bevere wanted was that chemistry, domestic bacteriology, domestic architecture, decoration, all come into play, as well as science, math, horticulture, botany. All of these things had to come to play in planning your kitchen and in running a successful kitchen. So she was very much ahead of her time. And I think, again, to use the Martha Stewart example, here we had somebody who was saying, your kitchen goes beyond your front door, and it goes beyond just merely cooking. And I was really fascinated when I was reading about her.
Mm. This idea of domestic science, mm-hmm. does that elevate the work of women and the status of the room in the house?
It's a good question, and I think that if we look back to the mid-19th century, and if we look at when the Industrial Revolution started presenting a sort of an opportunity for all forms of work to be elevated, I think that the attitude in the kitchen that was starting to come out from writers again like Catherine Beecher or Sarah Josepha Hale, and this idea that not only is there importance in the work that's being done in the kitchen, but there's dignity in the work, and also that this is something that should not be left to chance. And so, yes, I do think that it was elevating women as well in terms of the home space, but I think that it was moving towards this, I like to think of the phrase that was used was the no chance for error, no reliance on luck, that everything was just precision.
Hmm. In the 50s, I would say that we saw women taking off their aprons and leaving the kitchen, and now it seems everybody's back in there. And while your father did a great deal of the cooking because he, as a teacher, was home before your mom,
yes,
he also apparently liked doing the cooking. My dad liked to cook as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think today even more men are home in the kitchen cooking. And I'm wondering, is that having an impact on what our kitchens are like today, the layout of the kitchen and what's in them? Is that everybody's in there?
Well, that's a really good question as well. I think that kitchens now are a place where this is an opportunity to display one's talents, to display one's skills at cooking, and I think it's an opportunity for self-discovery and self-expression. And I think that any time there is a degree of cultural uncertainty, I was speaking with somebody last week from Good magazine, as a matter of fact, and we were talking about just any time there's an election year when there's a sense of just a little bit of, again, uncertainty. Mm. I think that we see people going back to their roots in different ways, and the kitchen is a great way to explore that. So you're asking if the fact that there are more men in the kitchen now, how does that play into that, and how does that play into the design of the room?
Yeah.
Well, I think that in families it's become more of a hub, so it's an opportunity, since there is less time in the evenings, I think it's an opportunity for everybody to get involved. In my own kitchen, for instance, it opens into the living room, dining room area, and I have stools where, while I'm preparing dinner, people can sit and talk.
Uh-huh.
And I love it. I absolutely love it. At first, it was a little unsettling for me because living in the city, I've always been accustomed to galley kitchens where I felt like I was just sort of in on one end of the kitchen by the stove and people were crowding in. And now this is nice that everything is open. However, I will say at first, it took me a little bit off. It caught me off guard because I didn't have a curtain, so to speak, to go behind.
Yeah.
If I dropped something or if I had to remeasure something or burn something. But now I'm very comfortable with it, and I think it's it makes for a more engaging environment. And, you know, it's funny because it's something actually, since we were talking about the 50s, it's something that was proposed very early on by Russell and Mary Wright in their Guide for Easier Living. Russell and Mary Wright, being a great design team, made a lot of great china and utensils, but also designed homes. And one of the things that Wright had proposed was, let's get rid of the pass-through, because pass-throughs were becoming popular, that sort of cut out little window between the kitchen and the dining room so that the cook or the homemaker could just pass the meal into the dining room. You know, let's get rid of that entirely. Let's open the kitchen up to the rest of the house. And what he had proposed, along with his wife, in the book Guide for Easier Living, was bringing your guests into the kitchen. Let them serve themselves. Let them help out with the cleanup. Let them help out with the cooking. And I'm personally not comfortable going that far, because I feel that if I'm having people in my home, I'm entertaining them. But I thought that was a very unique approach, and I just wonder sometimes if that was because, coming when it did in the 50s, after the war era, when families were separated for so long, now it was nice to have everybody back together again.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Stephen Gadula. He is the author of The Warmest Room in the House, How the Kitchen Became the Heart of the 20th Century American Home. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now, a listener calling in from St. Charles. Good afternoon. Line 4, hi.
Good afternoon. I like this guy. He's right up my alley. Actually, I'm a remodeler. I do a lot of work on Victorian homes, but he's absolutely right. There's so many different ways you can make your existing home a better place to live, and don't really need to spend a lot of money on it. But the focus that everybody seems to be going to nowadays is the kitchen/family room.
Exactly.
You were talking about walls. There used to be that, like, stub walls.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all coming out, you know, so they can have more of a, like you say, an openness instead of ashrows. And the other thing is, well, everybody here a while back started going to 9-foot ceilings. I think it's going to reverse, though, because as soon as our energy crisis gets in full mode, I think everybody's going to want to downsize a little bit as far as room size, all the gas and everything. But the kitchens and bathrooms seem to be the major deal for people wanting to do full makeups of their house, especially bathrooms. And what I thought was unique is that people are looking at taking out tubs.
Oh.
You know, basically that's what I thought. I've gotten a number of calls over the last couple of months to remove bathtubs.
Are they asking for a larger shower? Or?
Yeah. Well, you know, I have most of my family's in Europe, and their uniqueness is that their shower is basically a whole bathroom. You know, you got a shower, they've got all the plumbing in one corner, and it's an open shower. There is no lip, so to speak, and there's no shower curtain or whatnot. And what I've been doing is basically ripping that all out and basically not making the whole room a full shower, but, you know, section it off. But you don't have a shower door there anymore.
Well, I've actually wondered sometimes in different European villas that I've stayed in, because they are more affordable than a hotel, I've seen that, and there is the drain in the floor. And sometimes I've wondered if they've put the shower curtain in for the sake of American tourists.
That's interesting.
So I don't know.
Also, I wonder if that change has to do with us aging as well. It's easier to get in and out of, and I wonder if there are changes coming down the pike, and we'll bring in the listener again here and ask him, do you think that there will be changes coming as we get older in the kitchen and the bathroom?
Yeah, I do. I think you're going to see a lot of changes. I think it, not just in the way for handicapped. The baby boomers are living longer, so they're going to want to make doorways and hallways wider than normal for wheelchair access. And maybe, you know, not so much where we're at, but maybe in a different area. It's a regional thing where you have ranch houses instead of, you know, two-story homes, right. Or unless you have, like, an elevator. I see this. This is a trend. It's starting to kick away. And it makes sense. I don't know why. And I've always asked my question, you know, ask myself why these big tract home builders like KB Homes or Pasquale or somebody like that doesn't make optional handicaps accessible homes, because, you know, I see this trend going more and more. But I love this discussion, especially, you know, in my field. I'm doing this for 25, 30 years, and I think you're going to see more of this. Thanks.
Well, thanks for the call.
You brought up some great points.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'd like to change in the kitchen is have it be more comfortable to stand in there or sit and work.
Right, right. You know? And, well, as I was saying earlier, I have stools that I've brought into mine, mm-hmm. and I've had the lip of the island extended a little bit so that I can slide the stools under, three-quarters of the way around. So I find that to be more inviting for, like I said, for guests and family and also for myself. But what I was interested in was how many homes I'm seeing where there's a computer station
mm-hmm.
in the kitchen.
And there's a bookshelf.
Yep.
There's shelves.
Yes. Yes. And I was thinking about, it's kind of funny, a friend of mine is in development, and he has the new LG refrigerator with the screen on the cover of the door, on the front of the door. So it sort of takes away the need for a laptop or a desktop if you want to access something online in terms of a recipe very quickly. But I find that I like working in my kitchen. I like sitting down with my laptop and writing. I find it to be very inviting. And obviously that was one of the things that I wanted to pursue in the book, was how did we get to this point?
Yeah. Let's talk about the Great Depression. This is
sure.
a very interesting decade.
Sure.
The 40s, a time of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
The 30s. And you say that you argue that this is when America's great culinary expedition began, and you call it a time of shared caring.
Yes.
This is an important turning point in the history of the American kitchen, isn't it?
Yes, I really think it is, because I think it opened up people to other possibilities. Because I look at one of the interviews that I did was with Anthony Bourdain, who wrote Kitchen Confidential, and he has a number of television shows now. But one of the things that he said to me was that we ate more heroically when we had less. And I've really thought about that a lot, because I think about the one-pot meals that come out of the kitchen. I think about the casseroles. I think about what happens when you have less and you have to make more out of it. And I think in the 30s, neighbors were helping neighbors in a different way. And I know that in the area I grew up in, listening to stories from my Hungarian grandmother and other people in the neighborhood, that if somebody had a surplus, if somebody else was doing without, they in turn helped. And I think that what started to happen here was, in so many small towns in the country, you had maybe first-generation immigrants living next door to one another from different countries, sharing an experience of hardship and sharing the foods that they had. So recipes and the introduction of other foods into kitchens where ordinarily maybe they had not been before. I write in the book that my father's mom from Czechoslovakia had seen her Italian neighbors eating spaghetti and didn't know what the red sauce was. So she poured ketchup on noodles. I know. It's I think it's quaint, and it's not something that I would have wanted to eat. But again, but the next door neighbor showed her how to make tomato sauce, so that she wouldn't be putting this ketchup on top of these noodles. So I think that a lot of people have pointed to the 50s and the post-war era as a time when this culinary expansion really started. But I think that if we look to the 30s and we look at how people made the most of what they had and how boundaries were erased, I think that's when we start to see a willingness. Because when you're that strapped, I think that, as Anthony Bourdain said, you're going to eat more heroically. You're going to look for ways to make the most of what you have. So I think that was definitely a turning point.
Yeah. Also, self-reliance is important here, and the garden, once again, is important. What were America's backyards likely to produce in the 30s?
In the 30s, I would think that it would depend, of course, on where we were, but the traditional vegetables that could be canned, things that could go into the root cellar, because a lot of people still had root cellars, potatoes, I would think beans that could be canned and have a long shelf life, that sort of thing. So things that were heavy on the carbs, things that we would consider today to be heavy on the carbs, and things that had more of a stick-to-your-ribs type thing. And also, gardens were planted differently then in the sense that the entire growing season was considered. So things that produced late into the season, for instance, depending upon what zone you're in, I'm thinking of where I grew up in Pennsylvania, you could start to get cabbages, or you could have cabbages late into the year. So I think that was another example.
Yeah. One of the themes I think that I see playing out over and over and over again is one pot.
Yes. Yes.
You mentioned at the top of the show the crock pot in your kitchen when you were growing up.
Right.
And the crock pot had a forerunner, the fireless cooker.
Mm-hmm.
And the crock pot is back with us. And in the 30s, 40s, 50s, we had casseroles,
mm-hmm.
big time.
Yes. Well, I think that there is something, I think that in the future I'd like to look into this a little bit more, but I think that every culture has its one-pot meal. And I think that it came out of convenience. For instance, something, I look at the Powhatan, Indians in the Mid-Atlantic region of North America, and when European settlers first started coming over, they found them relying heavily on one-pot meals because everything could be thrown over the fire, work could be done during the course of the day, and this was something you could return to. And I think that the one-pot meal is sort of a cultural point of identification in a lot of ways, in a lot of different countries. But it's also, there's the ease of preparation. It's not something that has to be watched. But it's also a budget stretcher. And I think that if we look even to the 70s when the crock pot was popular, I also think, in a way, hamburger helper was another form of a one-pot meal.
Hmm.
Because here we had something where the ground beef was added. There were ingredients in the package that were just thrown in. And again, everything came out of the one pot. But I think they're great ways to make the most of what you have and stretch out your ingredients. But they, again, I think they speak to what the foods that define the culture that they came from. Like I've said previously, and I say in the book, my heritage is split between being half Hungarian and half Slovak. And for us, one pot meals consisted of different dumpling dishes that may have cabbage fried in with them and onions fried in with them, or chicken that had been stewed for a long period of time with sour cream in with the stock. But again, these very hearty meals, very hearty dishes that could cook slowly, didn't really require attention during the course of the day, but yet were very nourishing and very filling.
In our house, it was scalloped potatoes and ham was a big one. It was things would reappear. You know, you had the ham on one day and would reappear in a guy's down the line. And
ham and cabbage and potatoes is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
It really
is. Delicious. Stephen Gudula is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about kitchens, the kitchen of the 20th century American home. The Warmest Room in the House is the title of Stephen's book, How the Kitchen Became the Heart of the 20th Century American Home. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join us with a question, a comment. Maybe you've got a story to share with us about the kitchens of your life. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Does the evolution of the American kitchen in the 20th century and today compare with that of the kitchens of Europe? And that's got to vary, of course.
Sure, from country to country.
Yeah.
I would say, it would depend on where you were, of course, because I think that the Dutch kitchens were probably one of the best examples of a kitchen that would be similar in some ways to what would develop in America, because the Dutch had so much exposure. Being merchants, they had so much more exposure to other cultures and assimilated a lot of things into their homes and into their ways of cooking and into their kitchens. So I think that that kitchen would probably have evolved very similarly. It's interesting because I was just reading, I think it was in the New York Times the other day, somebody was speaking about the, I can't place the article, but it referenced, it was a woman from Africa talking about how her cuisine in her country had developed, and she actually mentioned the European model and said that Europeans were, in their homeland, much more separated from one another. So there wasn't the same sort of cross-cultural give and take that we would have in the American kitchen later, for instance. But this, like I said, this is escaping me.
Yeah, I wonder if it was, could it have been an article in The Economist?
No.
Okay, because there was an article recently in The Economist that producer Harriet Williamson pulled out for me about the kitchen, and it's the title of the article is Downstairs, Upstairs. And it looks at a little bit at how kitchens have changed and across cultures as well. And maybe I'll just share this with you. The more traditional family roles are, the less likely the kitchen is to be used as a living area. In Sweden, 30% of households say the man is the main cook, and nearly two-thirds of families socialize in their kitchen. At the other end of the scale, then 5% of Saudis use their kitchen socially, and a man is the main cook in just 3% of households. And also, there is a photographer, of Tim Durven, a Belgian photographer working in Africa, and he was in the capital of Congo, and there were a number of pictures that people used as, you know, you go to a studio and have someone take your picture, and you can choose from pull-downs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Kinshasa, of all the pictures that customers could choose as a background to be photographed against, the most popular was a bright yellow and blue European-style fitted kitchen.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Interesting. I'm actually curious as to what period that background was from as well, if it was something more contemporary.
It's contemporary. It looks rather IKEA-like.
Interesting. I see. I wonder if that speaks to I wonder what the appeal was. If it was the warmth, for instance, if it was, I don't know.
Hmm.
That's fascinating. And I like the idea of of the survey that they did with, and it was the Swedish, where two-thirds of the families...
30% of households say the man is the main cook, and nearly two-thirds, 66% of families socialize in their kitchen.
Interesting. Well, it's funny because this goes back, again, and even my desire to write the book, a lot of this goes back to, like I said, the kitchen that I grew up in and the fact that people always congregated in it. And I was thinking about this recently. I was thinking about the things that I first attempted to cook at a very young age. And I realized that what I was trying to do was make my contribution to the kitchen and make my contribution to the family, because it seemed that in my family, everybody was known for a dish that they made. For instance, my great-aunt Mary was known for making these wonderful, heavenly lemon meringue pies that to this day I have not found the equal of. The crusts were made with lard, and of course she hand-whipped the egg whites, and the meringue would be 6 or 7 inches off the top of this pie. They were just incredible. My grandmother and her chicken paprikash, for instance. My mom became respected for this cookie dough that she made. And this was something that I grew up hearing a lot of. There was a lot of, let's check with Aunt Leona, for instance, about how she makes this or how this is made. So, and with my father being such a great cook, there were things that he was known for. And this became sort of, as I was viewing it as a child, it seemed this is one way you contributed to the family. This was one way you contributed to the home, was what did you make? And so some of my first attempts, and I was not even 10 years old, I was trying to make eclairs, for instance, and they ended up looking like dough slippers. They never rose, and they just had sort of a flat, deflated hole at the end. But and another thing that I tried doing, and again, this would sort of show what was on TV at the time in the early 70s, I was trying to make what I thought were fancy Jell-O desserts. Because even Tupperware at the time was marketing products that were designed specifically for this.
Right.
This was a new thing. And Jell-O did a wonderful job of marketing this, the idea of, you know, taking the Jell-O before it was completely firm and beating it with the egg beater, and sort of gave you a parfait-like topping. And I was just fascinated by this because it was something I could make. It just took hot and cold water, some ice cubes, and it was something that I could do and present to the family at dessert time. And I remember being so proud of myself for that. So, but the fact that the local Tupperware lady was selling these plastic parfait cups and glasses was very interesting to me as I was looking back over that. But I think that that's another thing, that we all look for ways to contribute to the kitchen. We all look for ways to contribute to that, because I don't know. People have asked me, "What is it? Why are we drawn back to the kitchen?" And actually, Joan Cohen from HGTV had said to me early on when I was doing research. She said, I think that we're all just going back to a primitive state, wanting to be around a campfire, but this time it's just 50,000 BTUs, in the form of a stove. But I think that there's another connection there. I think that it brings us back to the traditions that food preparation came out of, and I think that there is something very primal about that, and it's a very strong connection.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Gibson City, line one. Hi.
Yes, hello. It's been very interesting. And first, I have a couple comments. I grew up in rural Minnesota, and I just remember our table was the place to be, even without eating. It was very much a social place.
That's great.
Yeah, and well, now we do our kitchen. I don't have a eat-in kitchen, which I'm you know, if I ever move again, that's one thing I'm going to look for, is an eat-in kitchen. But my husband and my son, and I have two daughters, we all help out in the kitchen. And in this home, we have a drop-in stove and then a built-in oven, which I love because somebody can be working on the stove and somebody could be baking something in the oven without running into each other, and that's been really handy. And I've been watching different shows, and it seems like the husband must be in charge of the dishwasher, because I noticed that when they're remodeling, it seems like the husband really wants that dishwasher. And I just was, well, my question is, you know, how does that work in with what you've been doing and seeing? And I want to say that of my three children, my son is the best cook. I don't know what I did wrong or right, but anyway, I'll hang up and I'll listen.
Well, thank you so much for the call. I think that as far as the husbands and the dishwasher, I think that there's a certain type of gadgetry that's very appealing about the dishwasher. And I know that I scan the pages of Consumer Reports looking for the most efficient, but also I have to admit that I was really drawn to the techie aspect of the dishwasher itself. So I think that that could be part of the appeal. I know, and I hope I don't get hammered by callers for saying this, because this might sound sexist in the male sense, but I think that men seem to like electronic gadgets in the kitchen. I know I do. There's something very fun. I don't know if that takes us back to, you know, the things we played with as kids growing up, but I think that there's a certain appeal there among men for the latest technology. And so maybe that's what's coming out in the choice of the dishwashers. And because that could have something to do with it. But also, I was going to say one thing that the caller reminded me of. I was recently in the home of a pastry chef here in Washington, D.C., where I live. And what was great was he had two sons, and in the kitchen there was a little step stool, and there was like a little box, and he was working around them. And I was surprised, first of all, at how effortlessly he was moving from station to station in his own kitchen and avoiding this step stool and this little box. And he finally said, I can see you're looking at those. He said, those are what my sons stand on when they help me in the kitchen. And I just thought that was great. Mm. I thought it was really great to see them there, and it was also great to see how he had learned to work around these. So that was very nice.
Yeah. Also, I think the listener's comment about the table. Mm. Maybe the table is the heart of the kitchen.
Yes, it is. Yes.
When growing up in our house, we had a great big round table that my father had someone make. It was like a special ordered from a restaurant distributor kind of a thing. And it was a formica top, and I don't know how big it was, 90 inches across maybe. And it had this stainless steel pedestal that stood then on a cast iron thing. It was like a restaurant table writ large, and that was the heart of the kitchen, and that's where we all gathered, and for doing our homework before dinner, after dinner, and that's where we watched one another cook, and everybody cooked.
Well, can I ask this? What was the shape of the table?
Round.
See, and what's great about that is everybody's equal around a round table. There's no. That's what I love. Yeah. I think that's great.
Well, there was conflict around that table, too.
For the favorite seat?
No, not for the favorite seat. But.
Because I had one of my sisters, God bless her, and fortunately, I know she won't be listening in because she's at work right now, but she had a specific place that she had to sit at the table, and the chair could not be moved one way or the other, and that was her favorite position at the table. And if it ever led to conflict, one of the things that my father used to say was, you should be happy you have a place at the table. When I was your age, I had to eat behind the stove. Now, I never understood this, because of course I would think of the drop-in stove, and I would think, what is he saying? This is ridiculous. How could anybody possibly, no matter how young they were, wedge behind that? And then I realized as I got older, it was because of the freestanding cook stove with the long exhaust pipe. So there was probably about 2 to 3 feet maybe between the wall and the stove itself. And because this was also a source of heat in their home, that was a coveted spot.
Mm. Well, just think when, I don't know if this is true of your family, but, you know, in large families growing up on the holidays, there were two tables.
Yes.
And when you made it to the adult table.
You had arrived.
Yep.
Yes. Yes. Well, we just went through that over the Christmas holiday where my parents now have great-grandchildren coming into the home, and there is no room at all around either table. And I couldn't be happier, and I can tell my parents are just thrilled. It's a tight squeeze, and it might be a little bit chaotic at times, and things are being passed between tables, and it requires having extra serving dishes, but I can tell that they love it. They just absolutely love it, just having the whole family there.
We've got to wrap it up here. We're out of time. Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you for
your
interest.
My pleasure to talk with you and have your sister visit our website.
I will.
Okay. She can hear the program.
Thank you.
Stephen,
thank you so much.
Stephen Gadula has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to look for his book, let me tell you how to spell his last name. It's G-D-U-L-A. And the book is The Warmest Room in the House, the publisher, Bloomsbury. And that interview with Stephen Gadula was conducted on January 15th of this year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. This year's vintage vinyl sale for WILL's Illinois Radio Reader is Saturday, May 17th at Lincoln Square Village, Urbana. Donate your CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment at any Busey Bank location in Champaign and Urbana. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information. That's 333-6503.
As Americans debate waterboarding and torture, on the next IQ Squared, interrogation.
The notion that we as a society cannot draw distinctions between a tough treatment and torture is frankly silly.
Everyone who knows that torture doesn't work is dead.
The harshest thing I ever had to do was to let somebody listen to Barry Manilow for 24 hours.
Tune in to the next IQ Squared debate and decide for yourself.
Saturday evening at 6 here on WILL Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer, on Route 45 in Savoy, online at wardenmartin.com. Information at 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
It's 1:54 Central Time, 57 degrees in Urbana. Let's take a look at the weather forecast for Illinois and Indiana. Not so warm to our north this afternoon. Winter storm warnings are in effect for north central and a portion of northeastern Illinois until late tonight, and in extreme northeastern Indiana until Saturday morning. Winter weather advisories are in effect in a portion of northeastern Illinois and northwestern Indiana until late tonight. Let's take a look now at Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. This afternoon in the north, mostly cloudy with snow, heavy at times. In central sections, cloudy with a few showers and isolated thunderstorms. In the south this afternoon, partly sunny. Highs ranging from 33 in northwestern Illinois to 68 in far southern Illinois. Tonight in northeastern Illinois and across northern Indiana, mostly cloudy with areas of snow and mixed rain and snow. In central Illinois, mostly cloudy with a few showers of mixed rain and snow this evening, then a few snow showers overnight. In central Indiana, cloudy with a chance for thunderstorms this evening, then scattered showers overnight. In the south, partly to mostly cloudy. Lows tonight ranging from 23 in northwestern Illinois to 40 in southern Indiana. The outlook for tomorrow, Saturday, partly to mostly cloudy with a few snow showers, mainly in eastern Indiana, a few lake-enhanced snow showers in northern Illinois, highs ranging from 35 in eastern Indiana to 50 in far southern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana, this afternoon, partly sunny and windy with a chance for showers and perhaps a thunderstorm, the high around 60. The wind from the south at 12 to 24 with gusts to 30 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy, the low 33, the wind from the west to northwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Saturday, tomorrow, mostly cloudy, breezy, and colder. The high 42, the wind from the north at 12 to 24 miles per hour. Saturday night, considerable cloudiness, the low 27. Sunday, mostly cloudy with a chance for a few showers, possibly mixed with snow during the morning, the high 43. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a chance for a few showers during the evening, the low 26. The outlook for Monday, partly sunny, the high 47. It's 4 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Coming up, we'll have news from National Public Radio. And then today, because the markets are closed in observance of Good Friday, we'll have the Commodity Week program for you at 2:06 Central Time. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
This is Station Manager Jay Pierce. You may have received a letter from me asking you to contribute to our Member Match Fund. I hope you respond, because on April 3rd at 7 a.m., we'll challenge listeners to match in 1 hour the entire amount we raise between now and then. The money is during our April 3rd call, 217-244-9455. Where else but with your public radio station can you have such a direct impact on success? Thank you.